morning session is a talk by Glenn Morris entitled News from Nowhere. So straight over to you, Glenn.
Well, I was hoping you'd take a bit longer. Thank you. Getting my nerves into place facing you guys. Well, thank you very much, Mike, for asking me to do this. I wanted to start without launching straight into William Morris's book, which is this one, News from Nowhere, that I imagine some of you, I imagine all of you are familiar with it, and most of you, I guess, might have read it. But before doing that, it's nice to be here again after these years of this dreadful pandemic that we've all been experiencing. I heard a few people chatting and some were saying, you know, the great thing was I've actually enjoyed it, but I think the only joy I got out of it, I guess, was well, you get to know the person you've married, which of course prior to that you hadn't really done, of course. There was that wonderful joy of never having to look at a diary and wondering what to do with each day. I thought that was quite good. I'm also going to also talk briefly, because I think over these last couple of years, one thing I've felt, and I'm not sure that or whether you have felt this before, I'm familiar with a lot of your faces, so I know most of you are people with socialist outlooks on life. But I must say, there's been a lot of talk of mental health and the problems people have had over these last 2 years. And if I had to be honest with you, I think I've struggled a bit with that. I don't mean that I'm suddenly going to have to go and deal with a massive depression problem. But I genuinely have felt this sort of sense of frustration that I think people who share our viewpoint have. And it's quite overpowering at times. And I think that pandemic thing where you every day you are getting up and there's kind of the same routine going on brought that home quite strongly to me. And what I was feeling was a massive sense of being alone, really. And the problem is, that's not a cue, incidentally, for heavenly violins. I'm just saying, you know, I did feel alone. And I think this feeling is why I feel a lot when I talk to people about socialism, and you perhaps hope that other people might begin to share some of your thoughts. And it is extremely difficult, extremely difficult. And I was saying to Richard last night very briefly that one of the biggest problems I think one has is this huge difficulty in engaging people with the idea of change, because most people, of course, don't want to change. Most people, they've built up a life, they see they've achieved something, capitalism itself has encouraged that, and it tells them that if they've got A, B, and C in terms of material wealth, then they've kind of, you know, they've got there, they've arrived, as it were. And I think the difficulty for people in facing a thought of change is one of our key obstacles. And I suspect one of our key obstacles, why, frankly, although this room is full in terms of the summer school normally, why we are so few in numbers, why there are so few of us, that always really troubles me. And again, when you have these conversations with people, you really think you've got somewhere. And then right at the end of it, they say, well, yeah, but in a socialist society, how would you buy something? You know, and you get that a lot. And you really think, oh, that was an hour. Really, I may as well have done something else, you know. Anyway, let's try and be positive. Because one of the great things about Richard's talk last night, I think, is the idea of being positive. And I think that is a really key point. And looking to a hopeful future where people do begin eventually to change the way they think about organisation of society. And I don't think this can be forced on people, of course, because they get, you know, it's very easy. I'm a classic case. I get kind of frustrated if I don't see people get what to me seems the obvious. But it's difficult, and you have to understand that people really are struggling with change. They really, really are. And of course, capitalism is a system. The last thing it wants is to encourage change. So its entire raison d'etre is designed to make people think this is the only game in town. Okay. I would also say that I've scored a few notes here. Unlike Richard, I don't have that skill to talk without some notes, I'm afraid. even people that are close to you, I don't know if any of you felt this, but even people who are very close family will still be detached from you. And that in itself is also frustrating, because the people you might be, maybe your partner, your marriage to them, or very, very close friends, and you have this sense of frustration, I do anyway, that they don't quite seem to engage with what you're thinking. And it's even more annoying because every day, if one listens to the news, every single day, it screams at you from the radio. Almost every single problem comes down to money or the lack of money or the economy or a problem with the economy. And I would defy anyone not to listen to the radio and just think about that. And so I say to myself in this, you know, these frustrated mornings listening to Radio 4, why doesn't everyone see that? And that I find a real problem, I have to be honest with you. So my wife, bless her, said to me, you know, she's, when I'm sort of spouting on, she said, well, you know, there are hundreds of other opinions, hundreds of other ways of organising society. And I suppose the frustration I get from that response is, well, yes, there may be, but why, therefore, are we going for one way that we know is failing? You see what I mean? So capitalism is a single method of organising society. It is so patently dangerous and failing. And yet, no, I wouldn't even mind if people said, oh, forget socialism, let's try something else. Anything other than this, I would almost say. Okay. Right, I'll kick off then, I think, and you've had enough of my sort of troubles. I make some apologies for this being slightly, well, I hope it's not going to be too superficial and lightweight for you, some of the more cerebral people here. But I, on the other hand, I would justify that in my belief that actually the problems we face are very simple. It's so obvious, I think, the problems we face. It's quite simply the way the society is organised, which is based, as we know, around ever-expanding growth at the expense of people and the environment, and of course profit. So we know that, I believe. But in itself, that is such a simple thing, and everything comes down to that common denominator. Okay, well, this is the book. Now, needless to say, I've read it before doing this. But this was written in 1890, as I recall. I feel mildly qualified to be talking about this book because my second name is William and my last name is Morris. So although I'm not related, I feel kind of qualified to be giving you a bit of a chin wag about this. So those of you that haven't read it, I'm guessing most of you must have heard of it or read it. It was referred to as a very utopian socialist novel, and a lot of Marxists didn't really take to it. I suspect it was treated, thought of being a little bit on the frivolous side. Nevertheless, the way what he's doing is he's basically dealing with a character whose name in the book is William. I guess he's taking his own name there, and second name is Guest. Because this character in the book basically goes to a political meeting in Hammersmith, I think it is, and gets into an argument. They're discussing, rather like we are today, what the future might hold for socialism if it were to come into place. And this character suddenly has a big argument with them, and he goes off in a bit of a huff, goes back to bed, wakes up in a socialist society. And it is interesting. It's quite fun to read. I think it would be harsh to say that it is too agrarian and too sort of all about living on the land sort of thing. I think it's a bit harsh to say that because he even alludes in this book to, and bear in mind this is 1890, to vehicles that are powered without any noticeable engine. So you could almost think he's preempted electric vehicles. He's actually on a river at the time, and there's a boat going by making no noise at all. And he thinks, well, it's not steam, it's not being rowed. These people seem to be just going along. And, of course, there's no internal combustion engine. So he's obviously thinking in quite a visionary way, and I think it would be easy to be scathing about it. There are bits in it, which I'll come to in a second, that you know, you do look slightly sideways at. But in essence, it's, I think, a worthwhile read because although it's William Morris, and it's done it with the arts and crafts movement in mind, there's no doubt, it is a worthwhile read because I think huge, huge amounts of it are still absolutely relevant today. Okay, so moving on then. So he deals essentially in chapter headings. So it kicks off mainly with chapters with titles such as How Matters Are Managed or On the Lack of Incentive to Labour in a Communist Society. So he does take on and takes head on some of the issues that a lot of people talk about, the obvious one there being on the lack of incentive to labour in a communist society. This is constantly a theme throughout the book. And again, I'll come on to that as well. I've told you about the chapter. So this the person's name, they all call him Neighbour. His name is William Guest in the book. And one of the things that runs very obviously through the book is, and understandably, of course, being William Morris, he's very keen on craft, and his way of approaching it in the book is he's constantly talking about the beauty of the and the way things are made beautifully, and we all know he was a believer in that, of course. And he deals with machinery, I'll come on to that as well, but in essence what he seems to be saying with machines is that I think in the book he wants to get rid of machines, really. He sees them as becoming rather obsolete. I mean, they take on a lot of the construction as they did in the Industrial Revolution and so on in the beginning of the last century. They take on a lot of that grind that working people would have had to have coped with. But on the other hand, he doesn't see them as imbuing art and craft into the objects that they're producing, as it were. So he's constantly alluding to things like, oh, you know, this is the dustman. He talks about the dustman has a huge fondness for silk clothing and has this beautiful sort of silk clothing that's all embroidered and so on. So these little quirky things appear now and again that are quite fun. Interestingly, it seems to me, this is where I think this utopian thing, the criticism of utopia came into the book, because throughout the book there is this entire idyllic kind of setting. So what he's effectively doing in the book is, with two friends that he meets, he's taking a journey on a boat down the River Thames, and he's describing it all the way to sort of Goring, Streatley and Reading and all the places you'd go if you were going upstream on the Thames, and how it's all changed. So he sees these horrible Gothic iron bridges are now gone, and they're replaced by these beautifully crafted wood and stone bridges, so there's lots of that. He's talking about how the sort of conurbation of industrial areas around Reading have gone, and there's trees and meadows and fruit orchards and people happily mowing hay, and there's a lot of hay in it, by the way, I must say, a huge amount of hay making. So there's all this, and everyone's happy, they're always kissing each other and hugging, and everything's utterly delightful. Now, one thing I would say that I think, and the gentleman made the point last night about, you know, what we're now facing, you know, I do wonder if he'd written this novel today, I think he'd have a pretty different picture of just how easy it is to create some different society with what we are now facing, and it would be very interesting to hear how he might do that. He gives everyone in the book, almost without exception, there are one or two grumpy people in there, but he throws them in so he can play the arguments of what if someone said, oh, it was better in the past and so on. But in essence, everyone is terribly happy and it's all very wonderful. And people that don't work, and this is an interesting one because he does deal quite carefully with this idea that people just wouldn't want to work, and he does it very successfully. But they have a disease in the book, and it's called mully grubs. So people that don't want to work have a disease called mully grubs, which is quite a good one, I thought. He does describe how some of the old buildings were kept. Not everything was razed to the ground, and I think he, through his own aesthetics, saw some buildings as being worthy of retention. So the Parliament buildings didn't meet very favourably in his book, and they became the dung market. and then a few other buildings are similarly. I think Hampton Court came out pretty badly, actually. Or maybe it's Windsor Castle. I don't know. But what I'd like to do, actually, is read you one or two bits, because it's no good me talking about it. You've got to hear it, his words, I think. So I've made some notes. I think this could be what, how he's dealing with Parliament. So, okay, so from the southern side of the said orchard ran a long road, checkered over with the shadow of tall old pear trees, at the end of which showed the high tower of the Parliament House, or Dung Market. A strange sensation came over me. I shut my eyes to keep out the sight of the sun glistening on this fair abode of gardens, and for a moment there passed before them a phantasmagoria of another day, a great space surrounded by tall, ugly houses, an ugly church at the corner, and a nondescript, ugly, cupolaed building at my back. The roadway thronged with a sweltering and excited crowd, dominated by omnibuses, crowded with spectators. In the midst, a paved befountained square, populated only by a few men dressed in blue, and a good many singularly ugly bronze images, one on the top of a tall column. The said square guarded up to the edge of the roadway by fourfold line of big men clad in blue, and across the southern roadway, the helmets of a band of horse soldiers, dead white in the greyness of the chilly afternoon. I opened my eyes to the sunlight again and looked around me, and cried out among the whispering trees and odorous blossoms, Trafalgar Square. So there's a lot of that, where he's kind of showing, you know, this movement, and this getting rid of this dreadful industrial kind of area. Interestingly, the Thames, his description of the Thames is beautiful, so it is an idyllic. You could almost imagine you're in somewhere like Alaska, the way he's describing the Thames. It's brimming with trout and salmon and people fishing and swimming and everything. Now, to us that may not sound totally unbelievable, but bear in mind when he was writing, the Thames would have been a flowing sewer. So actually it's quite dramatic the way he's talking about that. It's interesting in the book, in my view, that a lot of people he describes in the book don't seem familiar with the past. He sets it, I think, about 100 years or so in the future, but he doesn't seem to allow the characters in the book knowledge of the past. Very few of them seem to have knowledge of the past. It's almost been forgotten. Another interesting thing is he doesn't seem to have a lot of time for books either. I'll let you draw your own conclusions on that if you were to read it. But books don't seem to be, in his view, a great thing, funnily enough. He also alludes a lot, and this, I think, is a fair point to a modern socialist and a new socialist outlook. In fact, on the news recently, many times we are hearing that poorer people die sooner. That seems to be a fact. So people from poorer parts of the world, we know, have always died sooner. And people from parts of this country that have a lower standard of living, you know, maybe inner city areas, deprived areas, also die sooner. And indeed, we now know that diseases such as the pandemic affect poorer people and people of colour far more than other people. So he does talk about this, and he says in the book often how beautiful people are. Bear in mind, is this character, this rather haggard character from Victorian England that's been thrown into the future, and he's seeing these very, very haggard people, sorry, these very beautiful, fit people, and he often makes mistakes about their age. So he'll think someone's 30 when they're 50 and so on and so forth. So I think that's actually, oddly, a fair point. And I think that if you look at on our current news and in our current health situation, stress is huge, problems with people's mental health is huge, sheer fatigue is huge, time off work through sort of overwork is huge. And of course, in a socialist society, that wouldn't happen. So it seems to me not an unreasonable suggestion to say that people would start living longer, look better, and be fitter, and generally far more healthy. That doesn't seem at all, even though it's an old book, at all unreasonable to believe. there are some references that are of their time. Particularly with women, he has a sort of love affair in the book. So he's every woman he sees, because all of these women, he describes women sort of scything in the field, and of course they all look utterly beautiful. And I think he's got a bit of a thing about these imagined women all looking incredibly beautiful. And he has a bit of a love affair in the book with this woman called Ellen, and by mean a love affair, I don't mean some sort of torrid sort of hotel-y thing. It's this woman who he finds immensely beautiful, and he's sort of, in a very subtle way, sort of, you know, I guess he sort of falls in love with her. But there is a sort of, there's still a sort of slightly Victorian approach to women. I read you this brief paragraph. He said, I sat somewhat uneasy under this dry jibe. Indeed, his manner of treating this latter part of the question seemed to me a little disrespectful. Come now, my friend, quoth he, don't you know that it is a great pleasure to a clever woman to manage a house skilfully, and to do it, and to do it so that all the housemates about her looked pleased and are grateful to her. And then, you know, everyone likes to be ordered about by a pretty woman. Why, it is one of the pleasantest forms of flirtation. You are not so old that you cannot remember that. Well, I remember it well. So I didn't read that terribly well, but you get the gist of it. So there is a bit of kind of old-fashioned, what feminists might well reasonably look over their glasses at. Okay, onto the sort of the more less sort of frivolous stuff. He deals a lot with manufacturing and labour-saving machines. I'm just going to again read you a little bit here because I think this is useful. I very carefully put some bookmarks in here just before we started and fell out. Okay, so there's a few notes here. Said he, setting himself in a chair again for a long talk, it is clear from all that we hear and read that in the last age of civilization, men had got into a vicious circle in the matter of production of wares. They had reached a wonderful facility of production, and in order to make the most of that facility, they had gradually created, or allowed to grow rather, a most elaborate system of buying and selling, which has been called the world market. And that world market, once set a going, forced them to go on making more and more of these wares, whether they needed them or not. So that while, of course, they could not free themselves from the toil of making real necessities, he's put necessaries here, they created in a never-ending series sham or artificial necessaries, which became, under the iron rule of the aforesaid world market, of equal importance to them with the real necessaries which supported life. By all this, they burdened themselves with a prodigious mass of work merely for the sake of keeping their wretched system going. Now, Richard alluded to this yesterday, and it deals with, you know, I could go on, I mean, this is going to be extremely superficial appraisal, really, but of course, we all know that what we see available to us in the way of commodities and goods and wealth, if you like, none of it has been made, even bread, I would argue, for use. Bread has not been made for people to eat. It's being made to sell at a profit, as is everything. And of course, he's dealing here with so much so that it takes over an entire system. And indeed now, again, I think Richard was saying yesterday, so material is made before it is needed, and then a market will be created by highly, highly skilled, if you like, and paid market people, if you like, advertising agencies, to make people buy something before they even know they want it. Now, this is a ludicrous way of going on, if you think about it. And so he touches on that. There is also one more paragraph I'd like to read you as well. So, his estimate of the life of the 19th century made me catch my breath a little, and I said feebly, but the labour-saving machines. Heyday, quoth he. What is that you are saying? The labour-saving machines? Yes, they were made to save labour, or to speak more plainly, the lives of men, on one piece of work in order that it might be expended, I will say wasted, on another, probably useless piece of work. Friend, all their devices for cheapening labour simply resulted in an increasing burden of labour. The appetite of the world market grew with it what it fed on. The countries within the ring of civilization, that is organized misery, were glutted with the abortions of the market, and force and fraud were used unsparingly to open up countries outside that pale. Now that sounds familiar to me. This process of opening up is a strange one to those who have read the professions of the men of that period and do not understand their practice, and perhaps shows us at its worst the great vice of the 19th century, the use of hypocrisy and cant to evade the responsibility of vicarious ferocity. When the civilized world market coveted a country not yet in its clutches, some transparent pretext was found, the suppression of a slavery different from and not so cruel as that of commerce, the pushing of a religion no longer believed by its promoters, the rescue of some desperado or homicidal madman whose misdeeds had got him into trouble amongst the natives of this barbarous country. I won't go on, but doesn't that not remind you of the oil, Saddam Hussein, you know, Iraq, and so on and so forth? And the labour-saving devices he talks of at the beginning of that, where he's saying how much it makes even more work. Some of you, I suspect, here are old enough as I am to remember when the PC arrived and computers arrived on the scene. And do you remember how we were told that computers would allow our working day to drop dramatically? What happened? You know, the complete opposite. You know, even I'm guilty of this, I have to admit. You know, I'll go and do a quick email and I'm going, oh, YouTube, you know, and so it goes on. Or worse still, worse still actually is those people. And my daughter is engaged to a young lad who he's got a sedentary sort of job which involves computers, but when he's working from home, and this is interesting, so this pandemic forced people to work at home, what they're not doing is thinking, okay, I'm paid for 8 hours, I'll work 8 hours. No, they're not. What they're doing is, oh crikey, I want to be seen in the best light by my boss, so they go on and on and on into the night sometimes. So, you know, computers, anyway, and various other things don't actually seem to be saving labour. I think there's one little thing I'd like to read as well, and then I'm going to just read a bit more. Okay, so this is dealing with how making things well, and I think this is an important point, and again it relates to how socialism might look in the future. So that it may be fairly said that the great achievements of the 19th century was the making of machines which were wonders of invention, skill, and patience, and which were used for the production of measureless quantities of worthless makeshifts. In truth, the owners of the machine did not consider anything which they made as wares, but simply as means of enrichment for themselves. Of course, the only admitted test of utility in wares was the finding of buyers for them, wise men or fools, as it might chance. Now, he goes further into this, but one of the essence of what he's saying is, being William Morris, of course, we're all familiar with the William Morris fabrics and so on and so forth. But he, and I like this, he's a great believer in craft. And I think in a socialist society in the future, one of the key wonders that would come out of that is that, far from this kind of idea of communism as being everyone is wearing a blue boiler suit and doing exactly the same thing, it's all incredibly boring, and you get this equality term meaning something quite different, meaning blandness, a greyness. Actually, the complete opposite would happen, because what would happen is individuals would be allowed time, space, development of their own personal skills, and so on and so forth. to shine at what they are really good at and become really good and craftsmen. He'd like them all to be artists. We don't have to have them all as artists. They can be scientists, they can be furniture makers, growers, whatever. But it would give an opportunity for people to be torn from that dreadful link to where you're just a cog in a great machine, as it were. And we all know that, you know, years ago, you know, the village blacksmith was the village blacksmith. And I know that I'm going back to these sort of agrarian times a bit like him, but in essence, that person that made that those materials, made those things from steel or iron, wrought iron as it was in those days, would have had the farmer come along and say, I need a new bit for my plough, and he'd be making all that. And there would be a sense of self-worth there. Yes, he probably wouldn't have been paid a lot of money, and he would have had a hard life, but there would be that self-esteem there. And of course, the vast majority of work these days doesn't involve that self-esteem, which is probably why a lot of people go back and turn to hobbies in the evening after work. Okay, right, I'm conscious of the time, and it would be helpful perhaps to have a conversation. What I've done here is my older daughter is about to have a little baby, and I tried to picture how this baby, she knows because she had one of those scan things, is going to be a little boy. So I've set this in 2091. I'm not a writer, so this bit I need to apologise for. You're probably thinking, oh my God, that sounds like some really bad O-level thing. But forget that for a minute and just try and take it for what it is. I set it in 2091, and what I've imagined is that my grandson, who's about to appear, is in a garden, and socialism has been established, basically. So I've written a few pages on how the conversation might have gone, and I've already, you know, my wife typed this up for me. She's an editor. She's already pulled apart a few things, but one or two I resisted and I've left in. Some of you may disagree, some of them might think it's naive, but if it prompts some thoughts about actually how things might be, then I think that might be helpful. Incidentally, I've read that book now, so what I'll do is I'll tuck it on the bookshelf outside, and I think that money goes to us, well, to you, Mike, doesn't it? Your bank account that you mentioned. So I'll pop this outside, and if anyone hasn't read it and wants to read it, whatever it is, okay.
Excuse me, Glenn, what's the name of the book?
This book, oh, I'm so sorry, it's News from Nowhere.
Oh, that's the News from Nowhere. Yeah. From
hence my incredibly intellectually thought out, clever title, New News from Nowhere. Okay, so I'm going to sit down for this. So, okay. The elderly man was sitting in his garden. It was early July, and the flowers were looking their best. The hum of insects and the heady scent had a soporific effect on the man. Although just past his 70th birthday, he had lived 100 years previously. Had he lived 100 years previously, he could easily have been mistaken for a person in their early 50s, so young did he appear. His granddaughter was playing with 7 or 8 other children from the community, all gathered around a small pond, eagerly and intently trying to catch and study all the myriads of tiny insects and fish within. Anna, his granddaughter, moved away from the group, and perhaps feeling the warmth of the summer day, or just out of idle curiosity, came over and sat next to her father. The girl was 10 years old and had an inquisitive mind. "What were things like when you were my age, Grandad?" The man thought for a minute. "In what way do you mean?" "Well, we were talking today at the Learning Centre about how people lived before the rebirth. It sounded so sad. Do you remember it?" "I remember some things, but I was very young. Most of what I know is from what my mother told me. She was there when the change happened." "What changed?" the girl asked. The man looked over to her. "It would take me many days to explain this, and I'm sure in time you will read about the old times. But I'll do my best. What questions do you have?" "Well, what was a school? Why did people fight each other? Why did some people not have any food? And why did..." "Wait," laughed the old man. "So many questions. Let me attempt to give you an answer. In those times, all people in the world lived under a system called capitalism. Although it's hard for us to imagine now, this system meant that society, or what we now know as the people, lived in a very unequal way. many people unable to eat, and many more starved to death. The land was damaged, and even the air the people breathed was poisoned. Was there no food? The girl looked puzzled. There was plenty of food, but it was not produced to eat, but to sell. So if you had no money to buy it, you went hungry. I should explain that in that society, the things that we now freely take for use and to eat had to be paid for with what was known as money. Of course, we cannot imagine this now, but to survive and obtain this money, people had to sell their labour to an elite group of people who in return would give them just enough money for them to obtain the necessities of life. These people were known as the working class, although in truth, many would not want to have been seen as working class, as they had been conditioned to think that if they had acquired certain wealth, they were somehow different, and often referred to themselves as middle class. That was one of the great strengths of capitalism. It gave people a sense that if they were comfortable, all was well in the world. It was entirely about the individual, which I know you would find hard to understand. Moreover, exploiting the poorer people in the rush towards personal wealth was respected and encouraged. In fact, it was seen as a quality rather than a sickness and a horrible affliction, which is how we might view that behaviour today. I should also tell you, Anna, that the food produced, indeed all of the goods that workers spent long, hard hours growing or creating, all that had to be sold at a profit. What's a profit? Asked the girl. Well, it was a way of adding value to an item so that the owner of the factory, the capitalist, made ever more money and saw his personal wealth increase immensely. There were even some individuals who could pay for their own rockets into space without any noticeable effect on their personal well-being or wealth. And they could pay for whole countries to be cured of disease. But, I should add, that kind thought, though, never happened. They were rather keen to keep the wealth for themselves. That's horrible, said Emma. It gets worse, sadly. We were talking of food. Well, at times, if food could not be sold for a profit, it was destroyed. This happened on many occasions, and farmers would cover vast piles of so-called surplus vegetables with kerosene to make them inedible. All this while people only a few miles away starved to death. Did people not like to work? I think some did, particularly those who were able to work creatively, but even those luckier people had to sell their work to live, and so the goods they produced had to be made as cheaply as possible and as quickly as possible. So sadly, they never managed to achieve their full potential as craftspeople. Most people, though, worked as parts of a large corporation, making poor quality, cheap goods designed only to sell at a profit. They were forced to work on a very basic low pay in poor conditions. Even some of the larger so-called high street brands insisted that their workers ask permission to go to the lavatory and monitored the time they took, and the workers' pay was adjusted accordingly. The man paused. It was an odd thing, almost impossible for us to imagine now, but because goods were made to sell at a profit, the more goods were sold, the greater the profit for the capitalists. So the goods were made to become useless after a very short time. It was called built-in obsolescence. This meant that the companies could sell even more items and thus create even more profit. People were even encouraged to buy things they had no use for. But that's so wasteful, the girl remarked. It was. And as a result, vast quantities of goods were thrown into tips, destroyed, or in some cases, like clothes, only worn once and then disposed of. All this meant that the natural resources of the world were relentlessly and thoughtlessly plundered. If something could be killed, harvested, taken from the soil or sea, and it was profitable to do so, it would be done, even if this meant an animal becoming extinct or creature or creating extreme danger to human life itself. You see, there was a rather terrifying logic to the capitalist system, which until the rebirth was considered normal and quite acceptable. For example, I'm sure you know from your studies at the Learning Centre that there used to be an animal called the white rhino. Well, this animal used to be hunted for its horns, which could be sold for a great deal of money. It was once very numerous, but But as its numbers fell due to hunting, the horn became more valuable and therefore much more profitable. And so, logically, the last of the white rhinos to be killed fetched the greatest price. The logic of capitalism and the demise of a species. This has happened with a great many species, which sadly for you, you will now never see. The girl looked disappointed. But there are so many animals now, Grandad. Yes, that's true. You see, since the rebirth, so much has changed. Fish in the seas are now plentiful. It was a slow start, but nature is wonderful. And very soon we saw stocks of fish in the oceans increase. And not only that, the corals too have recovered. Once again, when the need for profit ended, things recovered. In the old times, fishermen, like all other workers, needed to sell their catch. And that was the reason they lived under such harsh conditions. If they caught no fish, they would have barely enough to eat. Even as far back as 1950, if a fisherman caught huge quantities of pilchards and they had exceeded their quota, the amount prescribed to allow the canning companies to have a profit, tons of fish would be dumped in the sea and wasted, left to rot. Profit came before people. Now, of course, we understand that the land can be used wisely to grow food and manage livestock in a way that is in harmony with nature. How did poor people manage, Grandad? You may well ask. I can't imagine how awful it must have been. My mother told me some used to lie next to busy roads begging for money to buy scraps of food. These people had nowhere to live. Why? The girl seemed by the look on her face to find this a doubtful state of affairs. There were many reasons, but in the old times, if a person was unable to work or could not find employment, they no longer had any means of feeding themselves or finding shelter. Some help was available. In those days, there were organisations called charities. These were groups of people who gave their time without pay to try and help the poor, or perhaps try and alleviate some of the other dreadful outcomes of capitalism. My mother told me that people were often described as being naturally selfish. So it seemed peculiar that they should work so hard to try and help their fellows in need. In our society, charities would seem very odd. In fact, I cannot think of what function they would play. It's our natural way to make sure others are fed, housed, and happy. I think the whole idea is now obsolete and meaningless. Perhaps I should tell you a little more about charities. The capitalists, governments, and big corporations were great supporters of charities. The girl looked very puzzled at this. They never missed an opportunity to be photographed or associated with one of the many charities. Some even set up their own charities, giving a minute amount of their vast wealth to show how much they believed in such work. But, and this is one of the reasons change did not happen as quickly as we wanted, charities actually helped the capitalists more than they helped the people in need. They moved the responsibility for all the horrors of the system onto the people. There were even appeals on the radio designed to make workers feel guilty about one horror or another that affected their fellow workers, asking them to send what little money they had to support the cause. It's all so hard to believe now. And strangely, people thought they lived in a civilized society. The other children had gone now, and the pond was still, reflecting the late afternoon sun. But the girl still had more questions. We were learning about wars and people fighting each other. Tell me about that, Grandad. The man seemed reluctant to discuss such an abhorrent matter. It's not a nice thing to talk about, he said. But people did fight, didn't they? She replied. Yes, they did. But happily now, wars are a thing of the past, and I would feel very uncomfortable telling you about the true nature of warfare. I will, though, explain a little. In the old times, the raw materials needed by the capitalists came from all over the world, many from poor countries where the workers had to labour long hours in very dangerous conditions to obtain the materials. On occasions, disputes arose between the countries and the supplies of materials. Maybe metals, oil, or chemicals became threatened, and so accordingly did the work of the capitalist factories. At this point, workers were told that their jobs were at risk, and if they did not fight their fellow workers in another country, things would get very bad, so they must defend their country. Wars were also fought over territories, particularly if the area or country was home to a valuable resource. much effort in time and resources went into creating what were then known as armed forces. These were people trained to kill each other, and ships and planes and vehicles were designed whose sole purpose was to kill people. Many countries participated in what was then known as the arms race. They were designing bombs and weaponry that could destroy the entire world population many times over. At this point, the girl looked at him but said nothing. Each country felt that if it had more weapons than its neighbour, it would not be attacked. The logic of capitalism. And sadly, people believed in this. They really did feel that they were protecting their country. The wars changed nothing, though. Millions died, blown limb from limb. And still the wars continued. Even the so-called war to end all wars in 1914 was not the last. 142 million workers died in military conflict after that. Now I mentioned that, I just remembered. During that war, when workers from what were then known as England and Germany were killing each other, the fighting stopped on Christmas Eve. During what was known as a truce, the soldiers from each side mixed together, exchanged food and cigarettes, exchanged greetings and sang songs, and, as well, helped each other bury their dead soldiers. When this became known to the commanders, it was quickly stopped, with a strongly worded order prohibiting such friendly communication between the men. Clearly, it wouldn't do for people back home to think that the enemy soldiers were anything other than evil. I think it's time for a rest. Let's talk of our lives now. As I said to you, it is so hard to picture now how life could have been back then. I've often asked myself why people put up with such an existence for so long. The truth is that I think it was as hard for them that so it was as hard then for people to imagine socialism, or what we now know as the rebirth, as it is for us to imagine a society organized under capitalism. Change was so hard for the people. They believed, and capitalism was exceptionally good at making them believe, that a system based on everlasting growth and profit at the expense of the people, the environment, was, quite simply, the only way to live. The concern that had begun to show itself on the man's face fell away, and he continued, "Thankfully now that is all in the past, and we are able to live happily alongside each other, respecting each other and sharing the wealth of the world. Perhaps most wonderful of all, beauty now has a value, not a monetary value, but a value that nourishes, sustains and upholds our society." "Do you think we'll ever live that like that way again, Grandad?" "No, I think you can be certain of that. Why would we? Even in the early days after the rebirth, those that had been in positions of wealth and privilege, the same people that had resisted socialism so vehemently, even they became happier. They realised that their lives could be happy and rewarding just by being valued as equal members of society. No, even they would not want to go back to the old life."